Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present journalist and author Sasha Abramski, who warns that democracy defenders should take seriously Trump's threat to weaponize his presidential powers to attack journalists and media outlets that he perceives as enemies. Chris Tittle, an organizer with the Elbit Out of South Carolina Coalition, who talks about their protest campaign targeting Israeli arms maker Elbit Systems U.S. facilities that makes weapons used in Israel's Gaza genocide. And Kate Kelly of the Center for American Progress, who talks about the current campaign urging President Biden to publish the Equal Rights Amendment in the Federal Register before he leaves office. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The southern African nation of Mozambique has been wrecked by its worst political violence since its civil war ended in 1992. Protests have escalated since December 23rd, when Mozambique's top court, the Constitutional Council, upheld the disputed October 9th presidential election results, naming Daniel Chapo of the ruling Frelimo party the winner with 65% of the vote. Independent candidate Venancio Mondlane, who election officials say received 24% of the vote, claimed victory, declaring that the election was rigged and called on his supporters to shut down the country. Since the disputed election, more than 280 people have been killed in rioting, where Frelimo offices, courts, and police stations have been burned down. Some observers say opposition leader Mondlane, who fled the country after two of his aides were killed, has fueled the violence with his sometimes incendiary rhetoric. With major energy reserves and billions of dollars in foreign investment in liquefied natural gas extraction by the U.S. Export-Import Bank and oil companies ExxonMobil and France's Total, Mozambique's future stability is a subject of growing concern to the U.S., Western Europe, and capital investors. Days before Wisconsin regulators approved rerouting the Line 5 oil pipeline through a northern section of the state, the pipeline's operator, Canadian-based Enbridge Energy, had a major oil leak on a different pipeline. On November 11th, a 70,000-gallon leak on the Line 6 pipeline west of Milwaukee caused significant soil contamination. However, the spill wasn't reported to the public until a month later. The oil spill has increased tensions between Enbridge and its critics, especially the Bad River Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa tribe. For years, the Chippewas, along with several environmental groups, have been fighting to stop Enbridge from rerouting the Line 5 pipeline through northern Wisconsin, which they warn will endanger wildlife and sensitive wetlands used by tribal members for fishing and harvesting wild rice. Working with a tribe, Earth Justice lawyers are now challenging the state's approval of the Line 5 pipeline reroute project. According to Inside Climate News, Enbridge has a long history of oil spills in Minnesota, Michigan, and Wisconsin, including its 2010 million-gallon oil leak into the Kalamazoo River, one of the largest inland oil spills in U.S. history. It took 130 years for the remains of Native American student Almeda Heavyhair to be returned to her family at the Fort Belknap Indian Reservation in Montana. Like many thousands of American indigenous youth, she was forcibly removed from her native home at 12 years old and sent to the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania. It was one of hundreds of Indian boarding schools established to eradicate Native American culture and assimilate Indians into white European society. According to a Washington Post investigation, over 3,100 Native children died at Indian boarding schools from 1828 to 1970, three times the estimate given by the U.S. Interior Department earlier last year. In October, President Joe Biden apologized for the boarding schools that he described as one of the most horrific chapters in U.S. history. Most Native children who perished at the boarding schools died from infectious diseases, malnutrition, and accidents. But dozens died under suspicious circumstances, including child abuse. Preston McBride, a Pomona College historian, has estimated that Indigenous child deaths at the schools could be as high as 40,000, 18 times the rate of white children during that era. He explains that these deaths were tolerated as collateral damage in the government's push to eradicate Indians and confiscate their lands. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
January 6 marked 4 years since President Donald Trump incited a violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol that took the lives of 5 people and injured 174 police officers. After Attorney General Merrick Garland's failure to hold Trump accountable for his crimes, this treasonous pathological liar, who was found guilty of 34 felony counts and who a jury found liable for sexual assault, was re-elected president on November 5th by a narrow margin, winning less than 50% of the vote. Before the election, Jeff Bezos and Patrick Soon-Shiong, billionaire owners of two of the nation's most prestigious newspapers, preemptively surrendered to Trump by canceling their paper's planned endorsement of Democratic presidential candidate Vice President Kamala Harris. After ABC News settled a Trump defamation lawsuit in mid-December, by donating $15 million to his future presidential library, the emboldened president-elect says he'll next sue the Des Moines Register because their poll understated his pre-election support. 60 Minutes for his criticism of their editing of an interview with Kamala Harris, and the Pulitzer Prize Committee for honoring the New York Times coverage of allegations of Russian interference in the 2016 election. Your reporter spoke with Sasha Abramsky, The Nation magazine's Western correspondent and author, who discusses his recent article titled, "Will Trump Weaponize the FCC to Crack Down on Media Outlets He Doesn't Like?" and the alarming anticipatory obedience we see toward Trump from some of America's most influential media companies.
And when it comes to the FCC, which regulates media licensing, essentially, you now have in the person of Brendan Carr, somebody who is absolutely committed to Trump's agenda of going after journalists and media outlets that he views as being hypercritical. And they've talked about all kinds of things. So Trump has repeatedly talked on the campaign trail about yanking the broadcasting licenses from major networks, ABC, CBS, NBC. If they publish stories he doesn't like, he says he's going to go after them. He's repeatedly sued and or threatened to sue media organizations and individual journalists. And we saw recently a $15 million settlement that ABC agreed to pay for something that George Stephanopoulos has said on air. Well, you know, if you go after the media and use the courts as an intimidation tool and you use frivolous lawsuits as an intimidation tool, and then you have the FCC backing you up and saying, well, you know what, we're going to investigate companies, we're going to investigate broadcasters that we don't like, we're going to deny their licenses, we're going to intervene to stop them being able to buy and sell their stations. Once you do that, you're on the road to what's called an illiberal democracy. That's a term that Viktor Orban, who's the leader of Hungary, has pioneered, which is that you have the trappings of a democracy, but you manipulate it so extensively, you intimidate the media so extensively, that in reality, you're guaranteeing yourself in power. That the sort of mechanisms, the breaking mechanisms, the watchdog mechanisms to hold you accountable start to break down. And that's both because you're overtly threatening media companies and basically intimidating them, and also because media companies are going to start self-censoring because they're going to want to avoid getting on Trump's bad side. It's sort of the stuff of Vladimir Putin's Russia, where you have the formal trappings still of a pluralist electoral system, but you really successfully stack the decks against effective opposition.
The really frightening part of your article where you detail the possible future use of emergency declarations to punish Trump's perceived media enemies, because there is a clause within the old text of the Communications Act of 1934, I think it is, where a president can use a declaration of an emergency to shut down media organizations all across the country.
Yeah, there are a series of Communications Acts from the 1930s onwards that grant extraordinary powers to the president in the event of an emergency. And the thing about our system of checks and balances and the constitutional structure and everything else is it works until you have a president who's willing to bust through it using any means necessary. Now, one of the sort of dirty secrets of the American political system is that in actual fact, there are a vast number of emergency powers that the president can use if he's willing to just say, you know what, we've got a national emergency, we're in a wartime situation. And it's very ill-defined what qualifies as a wartime situation. So Trump's now saying, well, you know what, I can declare emergency laws to be invoked because we're at war on the southern border against drug cartels and people smuggling gangs. Well, that's a very different definition of war than, you know, World War II, for example. But if the courts give Trump leeway on that, it opens the door to a whole range of emergency powers being used or potentially used, not just around the media, but around the invocation of using the military domestically, federalizing the National Guard, and so on. All of these things, Project 2025 and other advisors to Trump have been talking about quite openly in the last few months. I mean, there's no mystery to it. They're aware that there are these emergency powers that they can grab out for if they want. And they're aware that if Trump uses those emergency powers, there's at least the likelihood that the Supreme Court will be deferential to it and say, you know what, we don't want to tread on executive authority. Well, that opens up a scenario that we haven't seen in this country, which is that you have a president who, you know, has proven his contempt for democracy. He's proven his contempt for constitutional norms. He said he wants dictatorial powers. And he believes he has access to these emergency powers that would give him dictatorial powers. So then the question becomes, well, what are the breaking mechanisms? Who's going to stand up to him in his inner circle? Probably no one. Who's going to stand up to him in the courts? Well, you know, maybe the lower courts will stand up to him. Not really very clear that the conservative Supreme Court will stand up to him. Who's going to stand up to him in the Senate or the House? Well, you know, Democrats will try their best, but they're in the minority, at least for the next 2 years. So there is a real risk here, and I'm not saying it's inevitable, nothing's inevitable in politics, but there is a risk that Trump will reach for emergency powers that will do immense harm to the functioning of the democracy. And if he does that, one of the canaries in the mine will be he will go after the media hard and he will go after the media early.
That was journalist Sasha Abramsky, an author and The Nation magazine's Western correspondent. Find a link to his recent article titled, "Will Trump Weaponize the FCC to Crack Down on Media Outlets He Doesn't Like?" and related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Elbit Systems is an Israeli weapons and surveillance equipment manufacturer with facilities around the world. The company's production of weapons used in Israel's genocide in Gaza against Palestinian civilians has provoked outrage and opposition in the U.S. and abroad. That's included protests as well as property destruction at some of their facilities. When residents in Charleston County, South Carolina, learned about a secret agreement to build and operate an Elbit factory in nearby Ladson, activist groups came together to launch a coalition called Elbit Out of South Carolina. Although Elbit promised to create 300 jobs in exchange for government tax breaks, opponents of the company say few of those jobs have materialized. Similar protests against Elbit have been organized in Florida, Virginia, New Hampshire, as well as in the United Kingdom. In August, the Boston Globe reported that a series of protests in Cambridge, Massachusetts against the arms manufacturer led to the company moving out of their offices. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Chris Tittle, an organizer with the South Carolina Coalition and a member of Democratic Socialists of America, who talks about their protest campaign against Elbit Systems and the U.S. tax breaks the company receives.
They're receiving money from our state and local governments that should be funding our public school system to produce truck-mounted cannons, weapons that have been used in the commission of war crimes and crimes against humanity, not just in Palestine and increasingly in Lebanon and the West Bank, but Elbit Systems is a company that has produced and sold arms all around the world.
What kinds of things has your organization done to oppose the existence of this company in your community?
We have been picketing in front of its factory every single week for the last few months. We've been going door to door, talking to our neighbors about Elbit Systems, as well as the fact that our county council and our state government have subsidized it. And overwhelmingly, when our neighbors find out about this, they are outraged. You know, whether or not they're particularly engaged with what's happening in Palestine, people understand that their tax money shouldn't be going to subsidize a $1 billion company, let alone one that's producing dangerous weapons that are being used all over the world and are being used in our country as well. Elbit Systems is a major supplier of surveillance technology that's being used at the Mexico border right now to surveil migrants. The fact that it is based in our community, that means our economy is tied to this genocide and to U.S. imperialism. What it's also revealed is how deeply our government and our economy is invested in this Israeli genocide. It's not just our federal government that's providing direct munitions and billions of dollars in financing to Israel. It's our local governments and economies, too, that are subsidizing the production of the weapons that are being used.
So just so I'm clear, you were saying there was a secret agreement. Was this thing up and running before people even realized what was happening or what it was all about?
Effectively, yes. I certainly didn't learn about it until sometime last year. And that's thanks to the organizing of communities elsewhere around the world where Elbit Systems has set up factories. So when we learned about this sort of in the spring of 2024, we had been as a community organizing in favor of a ceasefire resolution by our local municipalities in support of an arms embargo on Israel. But when we learned that it wasn't simply a symbolic gesture to be in solidarity with the people of Palestine, but that our economy was materially linked to what was happening there, we immediately realized that we had an obligation to do something about it. We've hosted public workshops on who Elbit Systems is, what their weapons have been doing around the world, the intricacies of this tax break package that our county and state has negotiated with the company. It's all very intentionally obscure. And in fact, we still have no idea how much money Elbit Systems is receiving in tax breaks because none of it has been disclosed by the county. Elbit Systems is supposed to be providing up to 300 jobs over the course of a number of years in exchange for what will likely be millions of dollars of taxes that they don't have to pay. We know for a fact that they have a tiny fraction of that 300 people currently employed. In fact, when a reporter last year asked them about this, they said they only had 50 people employed. We see the workers when they're driving in and out. There's not that many of them. And I can tell you there's a number of them that have out-of-state license plates as well. That's blood money. We're not okay. We're not okay trading in jobs for genocide. That is something that our community is not okay with. And like I said, as we go door to door with people, particularly in communities directly surrounding that factory, when most people learn about that, they're very upset to hear it. We do know that Elbit Systems is not immune to the pressures of community outrage. They have permanently closed several of their factories. Communities in Boston, for example, have used similar peaceful protests and community organizing tactics that ultimately put enough pressure on Elbit Systems there to close an office space.
That was Chris Tittle, and organizer with the Elbit Out of South Carolina Coalition. Learn more about groups protesting against Israeli arms manufacturer Elbit Systems by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the Biden administration nears the end of its term on January 20th, a campaign is underway to pressure the outgoing president to use his authority, before he leaves office, to instruct the National Archivist to certify and publish the Equal Rights Amendment as the 28th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The ERA, first proposed in 1923, simply states that equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex. Although the ERA was approved by a two-thirds vote in the House and Senate in 1972 and ratified by three-fourths of the states, Virginia being the last in 2020, the amendment remains unpublished due to disagreement regarding ratification time limits passed by Congress, the last of which expired in 1982. As the U.S. Supreme Court and right-wing politicians take action at the state and federal level to erode the rights of women across the U.S., many activists look to the ERA to protect women against laws that discriminate on the basis of sex or gender. The overturning of Roe v. Wade, resulting in the outlawing of abortion and other reproductive rights, is but one important consequence of the ERA never having been ratified in the Constitution. Your reporter spoke with Kate Kelly, Senior Director of the Women's Initiative at the Center for American Progress. Here she talks about the current push to publish the ERA in the Federal Register, the role of the National Archivist, and Joe Biden's response to the campaign.
This is the modern resurgence of the call for constitutional equality. And since 2020, the question has been, is the Equal Rights Amendment part of the Constitution or is it not? This is a very active and live legal question. This is where the archivist comes in. Most people, only like a very small handful of people probably in this country who could name offhand who the current archivist is. Their main job is to keep the records of the nation. The archivist has a statutory duty, means there's a law that says once an amendment has been ratified, the archivist is the one who keeps track of all the ratifications. And once the requisite amount of ratifications are received, the archivist must certify that those ratifications have been received from the states and then publish it in the Federal Register. And that's the final step. That's the way that we all know that the federal government agrees and that it is the 28th Amendment to the Constitution.
So if the ERA became part of the U.S. Constitution, and there's complications that we'll touch on in a moment, but if it does become part of the U.S. Constitution, what would its impact be on things like anti-abortion laws, reproductive rights more generally, and workplace discrimination? What impact would it have?
And over 85% of other countries have a gender provision in their constitution. We do not. And so the litigation and the legislation are the two main ways that it's going to protect us from discrimination. You use the example of reproductive rights. That's a great example. And we don't really have to guess on this front because there are 28 states that currently have state equal rights amendments. They vary in language, but there have been many successes in the states protecting abortion access. So Connecticut and New Mexico are two examples, and more recent examples are in Nevada and Pennsylvania. Nevada and Pennsylvania, that happened just this year. And in both of those states, because of their state level equal rights amendment, they struck down abortion bans, mm-hmm. and specifically a prohibition against funding, so Medicaid funding for abortion. And they said that you can't just single out one specific procedure that only one sex gets or needs and say that you can't pay for that specific procedure. That is sex discrimination. So we've already seen at the state level that the Equal Rights Amendment can strike down abortion bans. And so we know, again, from the states that that's something that could happen also at the federal level.
You know, I've read some articles about the archivist, Colleen Shogun, Kate, who said that she's not legally certified to publish the ERA because of Justice Department memos and some court decisions. This is a fight, obviously. There's disagreement about this. So where does this fight go now, and how responsive is Joe Biden to pushing forward with having the archivist certify and publish the ERA?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very live question, but the president specifically mentioned the Equal Rights Amendment in an interview about a week ago, was asked what he wanted to accomplish before leaving office, and he explicitly said the Equal Rights Amendment. That's not common. A sitting president of the United States has not mentioned the ERA public since, I think, probably 1982. So this, he would not just say this willy-nilly. I don't know what exactly the White House is planning, but to mention it in such a specific way in this moment, I think is very meaningful. Colleen Shogun, I've personally met with Colleen Shogun when I was legislative director for Cori Bush, and she indicated, you know, some sort of ambivalence. And I said to her directly to her face, with all due respect, your inaction is unconstitutionally inserting yourself in a process you do not belong. She is not a lawyer, much less a constitutional legal scholar. She is an unelected librarian. Her duty is simply to proceed and mark when she receives ratifications and then publish it in the Federal Register. It is not her job to decide what is or is not in the Constitution.
If Biden instructs her to do so, is she obligated to follow that order?
The boss of the archivist is the president. Hypothetically, she could resist and then be dismissed or fired. And then there would be an acting archivist. But again, she is part of the administrative branch and the executive branch. And the boss of that branch of government is the president of the United States. Again, I think her inaction would be an extreme deviation from the process. Because if you read that Article 5, the founders wrote two things that need to happen. Congress needs to act and the states need to ratify it. There is no role for the courts. There is no role for anyone else. Her role is simply a statutory duty so that we know when it's done, that it's done.
That was Kate Kelly, Senior Director of the Women's Initiative at the Center for American Progress. Learn more about the campaign to certify and publish the ERA as the 28th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky and Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WEFR in Fairmont, West Virginia, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, KMRE in Bellingham, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.